This Thursday, the 27th of March, we are hosting our Spring Statement Coffee House Shots Live. Shots regulars Michael Gove and Katie Balls will be joined by very special guests Lord David Frost and Lord Maurice Glassman just hours after the Spring Statement, or Emergency Budget, is announced. They will be delving deeper into the measures and how they will reverberate throughout the political landscape, and this will all be taking place at 7:30 at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/coffeehouselive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that.
I am delighted to be joined here at the Spectator's Washington office by our US deputy editor, Kate Andrews, who is now living in Washington. Kate, I thought the point of this podcast should be to ask you how you're coping with the news madness that is Donald Trump.
It's very exhausting. How are we all really coping with it? I feel like in some ways it's at least good to like be in the heart of it. To just hear about it overseas must be actually more stressful for you.
Well, and I think the listening public just really wants to hear journalists whining about
all day long
how hard they're finding things.
It's all they want to hear is just how hard their job really is. Journalists can't complain, really, because regardless of your personal feelings about what's happening, there is plenty to cover and plenty to do. Let's look at this week alone. Donald Trump is talking about significant investment, billions, in the case of the UAE, we'll come on to that, trillions of dollars into the U.S. In the medium term. He is starting the process of eliminating the Department for Education. He is buying serious defense equipment. He's doing all of the things. The question is, like, how do you prioritize this and where do you start? I think we should start on the investment, because for all the talk that Donald Trump is incredibly comfortable about the tariff announcements and the trade wars that he's starting, and of course, we're not so far away now from the significant date, the 2nd of April, when he says that retaliatory tariffs are going to come in across the world on countries that he thinks don't give the U.S. a fair trade deal. The stock markets continue to reel and investors remain incredibly nervous. Trump can say all he wants that he's fine with that, but we know that this is a president who relies heavily on being able to say that the economy is fantastic under him, that people are richer under him, that the country does well economically when he's in charge. And, you know, he may be happy to take some hits in the short term, but I think these investment announcements are quite key for the Trump administration at the moment to try to offset what has been pretty negative press coverage about what's happened to the U.S. economy domestically since he took charge.
But I know that this is not the prevailing view of economists, but the bland fact of it is these are quite significant investments. Johnson & Johnson, $55 billion. The UAE, after a meeting with Donald Trump, right after his phone call with Vladimir Putin, interestingly, Sheikh, UAE foreign minister, came, didn't take off his sunglasses, but did invest, would announce a significant UAE investment.
$1.5 trillion over 10 years.
People know that Donald Trump wants to be able to brag about huge investments into the U.S. economy, and that is investment.
Oh, it certainly is. You can't deny it. It's so significant. I mean, when I saw the Johnson & Johnson news, and actually, when I saw the UAE news, really, the first thing I thought is, all right, well, countries at the moment, Western countries, are making some interesting and tricky new friends. It's not just the US, it's the UK too. Rachel Reeves, the chancellor there, went to China a couple months ago to try to secure investment. She secured about $600 million pounds, Donald Trump has secured $1.5 trillion into the U.S. Nobody can really deny that there are mixed signals going on here. And, you know, I think, sure, the vast majority of economists are really quite nervous about what tariffs are potentially going to do. But we also know that Donald Trump has a huge pull factor. He always has. When it comes to making certain promises and getting companies to invest, we should still question it, not least because you have to ask, well, what exactly is the trade-off for getting these huge sums of cash? What often happened in the first Trump administration is he would make a deal with business that they would stay in the U.S., they would invest in the U.S., they would build more plants or manufacturing outlets in the U.S., but he would also often be picking winners. You know, he would be saying, and we're going to give you, X and Y, creating a pretty generous set of circumstances in order for companies to stay. A lot of MAGA supporters would say, well, that's good. That's what we should be doing, especially when it comes to American business. But if you're talking about the UAE, you do have to ask much, much bigger questions about, what you're going to have to cough up on the other side.
Well, the Spectator, we know all about UAE investment because we had our own experience of it.
What a wild ride that was.
And of course, people get worried about the implications of it, the ethical implications of it. But there is this sort of simple Trump logic that if you're going to give us trillions, we'll take it. It is a good counterbalance to the turbulence in the stock market. I mean, obviously Johnson & Johnson, that's his friend Woody Johnson, who was ambassador in London, saying, giving him some good news when he seems to need it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, for all the talk in MAGA world that they're totally comfortable with this, what they're calling a transition process into a new world where we've got more taxes on imports, I would include Donald Trump in this. These are people who they're business people. They're serious people in that administration. They do understand that those tariffs are being paid by American business and American consumers. They say they're not. It's part of the narrative, but they know it is. And if you don't start offsetting that very quickly with some more positive news stories, you are going to find yourself in a bit of a spiral, as they have over these past few weeks with the markets. And again, I think somebody like Donald Trump probably can ride the wave of this for some period of time. But the thing about American politics is that, A, voters, they're quite fickle, and B, they vote a lot. And, it's a healthy, good thing. They're 2 years away from a midterm election. Donald Trump doesn't have a lot of time to be sure that he can really do what he wants to do. And actually, I think that brings us on to something else interesting that was happening this week around the Department of Education. He has signed an executive order to get the head of the department, Linda McMahon, to start the process of dismantling the department. I mean, the scenes were really something. He got a bunch of kids in to pretend to sign their own executive orders. I think for some people, certainly on the right, that will have been a sweet moment in some ways and a jarring one in others, because you're going to find a lot of people on the right who really support abolishing the Department for Education, that, the unions and the teachers and the public school system across America in so many ways have not been serving kids, especially underprivileged kids, and it's time for all that to change. But the use of executive orders over and over and over again, and it's one of the reasons that things are moving so quickly, sure, and he's able to make all the announcements, but the longevity of what he's actually trying to implement is obviously undercut by the fact that he is still not engaging his Congress, where he has majority.
But it's a federal system, and he's returning education to the states, which is something conservatives should be happy about.
Personally, I think it's great. I think education has been probably the number one issue, perhaps besides healthcare in the U.S., that's been needed to be addressed for decades now. It has not been serving kids. But I do think in terms of process and in terms of longevity, there are growing questions about, you've got 2 years till the next election, and the Democrats may well take the House or the Senate. Something could easily shift in those next 2 years. You simply don't know. Why are you not using the power of Congress while you have it? I mean, the answer is pretty obvious, right? It's tricky, and you don't want to start exposing some of the rifts in the MAGA movement, and certainly within the broader Republican Party. Yes, there's no doubt this is Donald Trump's party now, and actually has been for a really long time. But the moment you actually have to start working with other people, some of these very very strongly held beliefs within the MAGA movement could start to become slightly unstuck when you start engaging, say, other politicians?
Well, I mean, but to a certain extent, the Democrats are behaving in an amazingly self-destructive manner, not just the party, but Democrat supporters. I mean, there's been this ongoing Tesla story this week, and, you know, to a large extent, it's Elon Musk blowing it up brilliantly for himself on his own social media platform. But there are quite a few incidents of Teslas being blown up, keyed, destroyed. That, I think, is a great way to offend middle America.
Oh, absolutely. And the attack on Elon Musk, who I think brought a lot of voters into the Republican Party in the last election, will be certainly frustrating American voters. Americans love a success story. Plenty of Americans don't love the attitude or the personality of Donald Trump, but actually thought, you know, what Elon Musk's going to do with Doge and actually finally tackling the extreme and absurd waste with tax money is a pretty good thing. I'll vote for that. So there's that element of it. But I think it's far more baseline than that. Americans are sick and tired of the lack of safety. They're tired of this extreme kind of politics. Setting cars on fire at local dealerships is perhaps the worst way to win over the people that you just lost in that election. I mean, basic concepts of private property, basic concepts of safety in the streets and at a car dealership. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, what happens when one of these cars gets set on fire and there's like a dog or goodness forbid a child in the back? I don't think that's fear-mongering. I think like we're very sadly, if this keeps going on, like not terribly far away from somebody getting really badly hurt. That's terrifying. And Republicans, certainly in this election, around certain aspects of illegal immigration, around crime more generally, voters cast their ballot for the Republican Party because they didn't think the Democrats had a hold on this. And of course, the Democrats have really bad reputations in major cities like San Francisco, where they've become known, they've become associated with quite extreme crime. It's a bad place to be starting from. For this to be happening now, so early into Donald Trump's term as well, only makes it worse.
And then Tim Walz, who of course could have been vice president, it's easy to forget. He was recorded, I think it was this week, earlier this week, on stage saying when he needs a boost in the morning, he looks at the Tesla stock tanking, and he showed it on his phone. He has an app on his phone. And he said this on stage to an audience, and I think the audience seemed to like it. But that, which the Republicans now picked up on and spread him saying that, that again is knocking the destruction of an American company in a country as capitalist as America is very bad politics.
It's such an incredible missed opportunity because the economy is very shaky right now. And the Democrats, if they could get their act together remotely, would be coming together to say, you know, you voted for this guy, we're 50 days in already, you're feeling more anxious about your economic situation. Maybe you're feeling poorer. He promised to bring prices down. That hasn't happened. You could be making all kinds of claims, and instead they're mocking and making fun of an American company losing value.
And a lot of retail shareholders who will have Tesla stock.
Of course,
who will be suffering as a result. Or anyone with a retirement pension will be knowing that they are poorer as a result of this. It's extremely odd and self-destructive. It's a almost sort of suicidal type of politics.
They keep going out and doing really odd things. And even when they can get their act together, they then throw it under the bus. So Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer did have an interesting moment at the end of last week where he was the reason that the spending bill got over the line. The federal government did not shut down. The spending bill did go through. I don't believe he voted. He didn't vote for it in the end, but he allowed the procedure to continue. And there was a big question about whether or not the Democrats were going to do that. And Donald Trump was actually on stage at the Department for Justice during his speech, speaking quite nicely about Chuck Schumer, something that doesn't happen every day, saying, I think he's going to get a lot of credit for this. I think that this was an interesting thing to do. I'm paraphrasing here, but the words were really quite warm. He was obviously happy, but it was like a very rare moment of not even bipartisanship, like the U.S. is not there right now, but something like not so far away from it. And then Chuck Schumer this week decides that he's going to go on The View and start kind of hinting at the idea that your money isn't really your money. It's the government's money, and, you know, kind of giving that classic Democratic impression, certainly more to the left of the party, of like, you know, what you earn, what you raise, it's not really yours. The American people don't respond well to this. Every election we have had in recent years suggests that they do not respond well to this. Even the midterms under Joe Biden, where Trump's candidates did very badly, J.D. Vance was the one exception, Joe Biden's candidates did very well, arguably one, probably one of the big reasons Joe Biden thought he could run for a second term. Even then, when the Republicans really weren't doing so well, the reasonable politicians in the Democratic Party were looking around going, where we put up socialist candidates, where we put up far-left candidates, this did not go well for us. America is telling us that they like people being normal, being calm, and not being too extreme. So Chuck Schumer had a good week last week, is now topic of news in America this week, and it's not a line the American public, broadly speaking, agrees with. In America, they, you know, people feel strongly that it should be a fair system, but they definitely think that if they earn money, it's the money that they've earned.
Mm. Well, and our colleague Matt McDonnell,
next to us, listening to
away,
us, bored of us,
shaking his head disapprovingly at our thoughts,
disagrees with everything we're saying.
He said to me earlier that, you know, Schumer would be the last of the Democratic gerontocrats to go. And that might now happen. So you've lost Nancy Pelosi, obviously Joe Biden's gone. The influence of the Obamas is an open question. The older generation of Democrats are on the way out, but the younger generation does not seem equipped to take the party on to mount a serious challenge to Trumpism.
It's a very good point. And a very important one, because the Democratic Party, somewhat to its credit, people like Nancy Pelosi spent a lot of effort trying to suppress the more radical views in their party from the younger generation. Nancy Pelosi and the Squad, for example, have been arch rivals at many points throughout the past decade when it comes to their views on public policy. And with Joe Biden, the Democratic Party did a pretty good job of suppressing those views. But what it didn't do is fill the party or move the party to a much more rational and sort of, I don't even want to say middle of the road, but just sort of reasonable place. And the results of the election in November showed this. The fact that, again, Americans who are, in my personal experience, like incredibly thoughtful people, just thought that the Democratic Party had gone way too far, particularly when it came to social issues, cultural issues, woke issues. And I think that Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, they all made quite a grave error. If Kamala Harris, who, you know, is on the younger side and was quite fresh and certainly energetic and all the rest of it, she was coming forward with these really radical policies. You've made a mistake in the older generations if that's who you're producing, if that's the next wave. And I think this is going to be the real problem for the Democrats, is that they were only able to suppress it for so long. And now the question is, who's going to be left in the party when they go?
Well, finally, Kate, I wanted to ask you about your impressions of Washington, because when we were here for the inauguration, I was here then, and there was a lot of this sort of excitement on the right, golden age, MAGA was cool, that sort of sentiment. And do you feel that that is carrying on, or is the anxiety about the stock market limiting that? I mean, it's obviously still a deeply democratic city, but there is now a more of an established MAGA presence here, I would say. And you have these sort of visible symbols like the Black Lives Matter Plaza being uprooted. We walked past it yesterday, quite extraordinary. Is it still feeling like the Trump revolution is ongoing and gathering pace, or do you feel this sort of anxiety is already kicking in?
The town feels dominated by the administration, but I think there's a lot to take away on just sort of, you know, immediate reflections. First of all, DC is really busy. I have only just got here a couple of days ago, but speaking to people like Matt, our colleagues here, Speaking to people who have been in DC for decades, they are all saying a couple of years ago, it really was dead. And now it's vibrant and alive again. And people are back in the streets and traffic has returned. People are looking for office space. Like, people know that the administration is in DC. And by that, I mean, people have returned, like the worker has returned. Elon Musk has said to government officials, you're coming back to the office or you're not going to have a job come autumn. This administration cares a lot about being present and being here. And you can tell that everybody is responding to that and very much flocking to DC. And it definitely feels, because we're still so early into this term, that the Trump narrative continues to dominate. It doesn't feel like in DC, Democrats are getting much of a word in edgewise. I don't think that reflects the rest of the country. And this is an interesting thing about having your political capital be separate from your media capital or your financial capital or your cultural capital, the conversations happening as well as other places are probably a lot more mixed. But DC is definitely MAGA dominated, and it's hard to imagine a world in the near future where it's not. The other thing I've been really surprised by, and I haven't spent time in DC for a long time, is just how beautiful the Capitol is. I mean, I think I've always known that. I went on school trips here and I lived here very briefly when I was in my early 20s. But I don't know, I didn't expect anything else. But when you do walk around DC, because it is all politics and because it is all monuments and it is all a testament to American history, it's really a beautiful thing to come see from other parts of the country, or certainly if you're out of the country. It feels very fresh at the moment. It feels very exciting. It looks beautiful. A lot of people I've spoken to said they've cleaned it up a lot. It looks really good, something that's happened only in the past couple of months. Whether the politics remain so easy for Donald Trump in addition to that is, I think, where that sticking point may be.
On that very American patriotic note, we'll end it there. But thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.